Frank Kane, alcoholic. And thanks to Gabe and the committee for inviting me down here tonight. And to all my buckos and the guys and the gals who came down with me from Las Vegas. There's a whole bunch of people here tonight. My God, I know a gang of you people down in the room here. I know a lot of people in every meeting I go to, because I go to a lot of meetings. I sobered up back in Ireland on the 6th of August, 1982. And from that day to this, I haven't needed a drink or any kind of a mood-altering chemical, except when they put me on the operating table and stuck a thing in my vein and said, you push the button. You know, that morphine stuff, and they replace your hip. Apart from that, that's about all I needed. Came out of hospital and took a few pills for a few days, and very, very, very wary of those pills. Very, very wary of them. I've seen so many people lose their sobriety with those pills. But apart from that, I've gone to a lot of meetings. At the end of any year in the past 22 or coming on 23 years, at the end of any year, I'll have about a meeting a day done. I don't say that to brag or to boast, or I don't say that it's absolutely necessary, but the way I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous is the way, and I think this is a gift, I feel the same way about AA that I used to feel about the pub. I just love to go to the pub. And I often summarize my drinking experiences with, first it was fun, then it was fun and problems, and then it was problems. When it gets to that, the game is over. When it gets to the latter stages of alcoholism, there's no fun left. I was born and raised down in the west of Ireland. It was a very poor place at the time. It's not so poor now, but it was very poor at that time. There was very little employment, virtually no employment. We had no electricity, we had no running water, and we went to school on our bare feet. But I didn't know I was poor. I mean, everybody else went to school on their bare feet, and everybody else around where I came from just didn't have electricity at that time. It came a few years later, but we didn't have it when I was born, when I was raised, until I immigrated. I went off to England looking for work as a labourer at 14 years old. And that was no big deal, because, I mean, you get plenty of work where I came from, but you get no wages. So I went over to England, and I got work, and I got paid for it. So, boy, I was a happy camper. Man, I was delighted with myself. I had another bunch of young bucks like myself, and we'd go off to dances at the weekends and be looking at the girls and dancing with the girls. And, oh, man, I thought this was fun. Never took a drink. I didn't say. I took a pledge. In Ireland, when we were kids, we were all Catholics. And we took this pledge that we would never, ever pick up a drink of alcohol. And, you know, a lot of people mentioned, my brother never, to this day, never broke that pledge. My brother Paddy. Some of the guys in the room here know him. He's been over here, and some of these guys in the room here tonight have been over to Ireland with me. And Paddy never took a drink in his life, to this day. I didn't take a drink until I was 23 years old. My brother Mickey didn't take a drink until he was about 35. And Mickey can take a drink, take it or leave it. And I just happened to be the alcoholic one in the family. And for years, you know, I was puzzled. I didn't know the hell what was the matter with me, because I quit drinking. And I swear to God, I would say, well, if I can quit this goddamn drink, I'll get it together. And you know, I would. I'd get some stuff done. I'd get a bunch of guys that are working for me. And the next thing, when all would be going well, I'd pick up a drink again. Unbelievable. For no good reason, I'd pick up a drink again. And that used to go on and on and on until I started to get picked up. Then I started to get locked up in England. And I got locked up about six times. I was locked up. All drink related. And then finally there was like a 7-year sentence hanging over my head. And you know, an Irishman in an English jail doesn't do really well. Especially at that time. Especially at that time when they were throwing bombs around the place over there. And anytime I get picked up, they'd let me know what they thought about me. Just because I had this brogue. And I wasn't throwing the bombs myself, but I was no angel either. So, anyway, it was just unbelievable the stuff that was going on. I was married. I've been married all my life. I swear to God, well, until 7 years ago. I'm not married no more. But anyway, I was married since I was 20 years old, and always had a couple of kids or three kids, and the next thing I started getting homeless. Unbloody real. I had a house bought and paid for one time. Bought and paid for. And I went in and borrowed £4,000 against it. I never paid a penny of it back. Not a penny. I've come to find out since I came to AA, a lot of people did shit like that. But out there, you know, normal people, they just don't do that kind of stuff. And I tell the newcomers nowadays, I said, don't talk to normal people the way you talk to us guys in AA. They'll run away from you. So it was not, because they just don't understand this nonsense. My family didn't understand that carry on that I was going on with at all. My father used to look at my two brothers, and then he'd look at me and he'd shake his head. He used to say, that fella isn't right. And another thing he'd say, and I used to always have, I always had buckles like myself around me, you know, like we do. We attract, light attracts light. And I would always have somebody like myself, bring him home and introduce him to my dad and my mom as being a really good guy. My dad would tell my mother when I'd leave, that Frank is losing it, you know. He's losing it. He thinks this jackass he brought home tonight is a good guy. You know, and it's terrible. But that's the way we are. That's the way we are. You know, we talk about all kinds of adversities and crazy carry on in these rooms, and everybody laughs their heads off about it. And you start talking to normal people about that, they'll shake their head, they'll get away from you. They mightn't say much, but believe me, they're not going to be handing out any promotions or any big jobs. That's just the way it is. That's called alcoholism. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I mean, to this day, this is 2005 already, and for the last 100 years or so, they've been really, really trying to find out about this disease. And especially in recent years, they're doing a ton of research at the moment, as we speak right now. There's loads of studies being done on this disease here. Harvard is doing a big study at the moment on it. And, you know, they're still just about as baffled as they were back in 1935 when Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson got together and put this deal together. The medical world is still, they know very little, they know a little bit more, but not very much more. I don't know how close they are to getting a patch. Maybe someday we'll get the patch and we'll all be able to drink a little glass of wine. I know, you know something, I was just saying to Frank Sweeney down there, he's up there in the room with me, and I was saying to him this evening, I said, you know, Frank, I said, I know a lot of people, and I know a lot, and I know quite a few wealthy people. And I said, you know, Frank, there's two people that I know, and I don't know anybody who's having a better time than them in this life. And he said, who is that? I says, you or me. Trovis, he's lying on one bed and I'm lying on the other bed. And we have a packet of trail mix nuts between the beds. And I said to him, if they asked me to eat two of these packages, I couldn't eat it. I couldn't eat two of them. I couldn't sleep in two of these beds, I said. We're going down now this evening to the restaurant for a bit of dinner, I said. I'll guarantee you we couldn't eat two dinners. And I'm with my friends. I'm with all my buddies. I was at a birthday party this morning. I had a birthday breakfast this morning. One of the lads I sponsored, Don Williams, is he here? He's down here somewhere. He's downstairs feeding himself. That's where he is. He just celebrated 10 years today. What a deal. Don, are you here, Don? He's probably downstairs. Anyway, he was here a few minutes ago. But this is the stuff. Well, I came across the parking lot today at Stairway 1 from the restaurant after eating the breakfast. And I thought, what a beautiful day. What a beautiful day. I had my breakfast with about 8 or 10 of my friends. Went in, had an AA meeting, and the hooting and hollering at that meeting. There he is. I'm getting blind. I couldn't see it in the front row. And he's 6'6". I don't know where I'm coming from. But we had the nicest time. We tore strips off this guy. I didn't say so much, but his buddies did. And they're roasted his ass today. And but he's well able for it, because he attends two particular meetings that I go to every Saturday and Sunday morning. We're at an 8 a.m. meeting on Saturday and Sunday morning downtown Las Vegas called Samaritan House. And I'll tell you something. They will kick in your skin up there. I better get a bit closer to this thing. If you think you have thin skin, like most of us have when we come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We come, Nicky Bush has arrived, so well, geez, they're all here now. If you come to AA like we all did with this thin skin, like, are you talking about me? Are you looking at me? What did he say? What's he saying? Come down to Samaritan House on Saturday and Sunday morning. We'll put a couple of layers of skin on you down there. I'm telling you now. And what a deal. Guys with 10, 20, 30, 40 years sobriety. That's one thing about Las Vegas, is it attracts a lot of retirees with a lot of sobriety. We've got meetings in there. It's nothing to see half a dozen people at a meeting with over 40 years sober. Amazing. No, I've traveled the world. I've traveled the world sober. And I've been at meetings all around the world, from all over the place. There's no place I've ever been that you come across this kind of sobriety, this longevity. And I mean guys doing the deal at 40 years sober, going to a lot of meetings and sponsoring a lot of people. They're not just 40 years sober going to a meeting once a year to pick this cake up. There's one or two of them around as well. We know them. And we name them every so often. Anyway, we don't judge them. Much. But that's one of the wonderful things I find about living in Las Vegas. And of course there are other parts of the country too that have a lot of retirees and a lot of long term sobriety. But I just happen to be lucky that I'm living there. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as the result of a lot of years, well, particularly the last year and a half when I couldn't quit drinking. I'd been living in England for a lot of years. Then I became a musician, and I was the guy most likely to succeed, I was told, and all that stuff. I came out to, I was brought out to Chicago in the 60s as a band leader, and I was sent around this country sorting out bands and all that stuff. And then I went back to England, and I was a band leader over there for this one outfit, this organization, and then the drinking got a hold of me. I thought I could make no money at the music. I saw a lot of guys like myself who had gone on in years and were still showing up with their tuxedos and their instruments and nothing. And I said, I got to get out of this music. And I thought it was the music that was my problem. You know, I quit three times. And after the third time, I gave my saxophone away. I said, if I give this thing away, I'm not going to go back to the music. And I never did go back to the music. But my life didn't get any better. It didn't get much better. And then it started to get worse. Some years later then, it started to get worse. I bought a bar. First of all, when I was in Chicago, I bought a bloody bar in Chicago when I was in my 20s. And I lasted 1 year in that place. Now, the whole of the Irish community in Chicago knew me. And they knew a bar was not the business for Frank Keane to be in. Well, I leave Chicago and I go back to Manchester. I buy another bar in Manchester. I last another year in that bar. I'd be afraid to tell you some of the things that happened in that bar. But there was stuff happened in that bar that shouldn't have happened. Then I said, well, I'll go back to Ireland and I will never, ever be tempted to buy a bar again. Well, I go in for a cure one morning into a place. Then I brought a bunch of slot machines and poker machines, and I had poker machines when nobody had them. I had poker machines before they were in Las Vegas, actually. They came to Vegas a couple of years later. But I had poker machines over there in Ireland and pool tables and all that stuff going back in the early 70s. And I went in for a cure one morning to this place I had a slot machine in. And the bar owner and myself, we cleaned his place up. His bartender came in, we went out the road to finish off the cure, and by 12 o'clock that day I had a bloody pub bought off him. Mad drunk. I called my brother up down the country. I said, Paddy, this is the brother who never drank now. I thought if I get him in partnership with me, he'll keep me straight. And we'll make a real go of this bar. Well, I tell you, after about 2 years, he was looking into a doctor's eyes. And the doctor had him on Valium. That's as true as God. And I remember one day he came in, he called me into the back kitchen, and he busted out crying. And he said, I can't watch you killing yourself. He said, I got to get away from you. And you know, it was like he'd stick a knife into me. I thought, this, has it come to this? Either this is terrible. this. I couldn't believe that my brother would, you know, this guy wasn't a fellow that would cry too easy. But he said, I've got to get away from you, Frank. He said, I cannot be with you. He said, I can't watch you kill yourself. So I said, that's it. I never take a drink again. And I quit drinking that day. And 6 weeks later, not a good day and not a bad day, but a day that most all of you identify with for no good reason. Drinking a 7-Up, stick of vodka in that. No big deal, nobody paid any attention. The start of an 18-month runner. At the end of the 18 months, I couldn't get a day off it. Every day, sick as a dog, puking, up to the point. Then I could drink nothing. Then at that stage of the game, my tolerance had gone way down. I didn't know what was going on. I could only drink a few drinks and I was drunk. And then I'd try and eat a bit and try and get sober a little bit again. And then a couple of more drinks and I'm drunk again. It was like a nightmare. Then I was afraid to go to bed at night. The room was, there was demons coming at me and all kinds of shit going on. Man, oh man, I was in that state for a year and a half. I was in an awful state with that bloody vodka. Drinking that vodka all the time, just sipping at it. Couldn't drink, couldn't really drink like I used to drink. I mean, I could drink 2 or 3 bottles of that stuff one time. Now I couldn't drink a half a bottle. And I'm drunk out of my head. And I'm repeating myself. I'm telling people stories twice and 3 times. It's like I was losing my mind or something. And people say to me, you told me that a few minutes ago. I said, oh really, did I? Jesus Christ, it was a nightmare. Anyway, in a fit of desperation, I picked the phone book up one morning and I was living in Ireland, living in Dublin. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I said to them, do you have a doctor there? She said, no, we don't. I said, do you have a counselor? She said, no. I said, who are you? She said, my name is Anne. I'm an alcoholic. I thought, Jesus, Mary and Joseph. What a statement to make. This must be some outfit. This outfit, I thought to myself. My name is Anne and I'm an alcoholic. I can't see anybody saying that on the phone to you. I thought, this is... Anyway, she noticed the pause. She said, are you there? I said, I am. I'll never forget this now. Because I was told, keep your memory green. And I remember this well. Because I got to know her and the guy that she tried to put on the phone to me, Jerry. She said, I have a man here. Would you like to talk to him? I said, no, no. I said, is he a doctor? No. She said, he's not. Is he a counselor? No. What is he? She said, he's an alcoholic. I said to her, you're there. I could see the address in the phone book. I said, you're there in Essex Quay. She said, yeah. I knew Essex Quay well. I said, you look across the river there. I said, there's a big pub on the far side of the river down there called the Connacht Man's Ramble. I said, I own that place. I'm throwing goddamn alcoholics out of that place every day. Okay. She said to me, okay. I thought, this is ridiculous. So she said, where do you live? I said, I live in Killiney. She said, well, there's a meeting down the road from you a little bit there, she said, at 1 o'clock today. I said, will there be a doctor there? Same thing, same shit again. Alcoholics, she said. And I said, okay, thanks very much. So I get off that phone and my Jesus, I'll tell you something, I don't know where to turn. I don't know where. My wife was in the bed there. She was drunk too. She was as bad as myself. At this stage of the game, she had turned to the drink. And this friggin' doctor told me that I'd made an alcoholic out of her. And I was kind of inclined to believe him. He says, you turned that woman into an alcoholic. I said, how did I do that? He said, well, I knew you, he said, and when she'd want to go home at night, he said, you'd never want to go home. He said, you kept her out all night and drinking, and now she's hooked on this stuff like you. Anyway, I went down to that meeting, first meeting, and I parked my car right round the block. And I walked over and he was looking around me like this to see if anybody would see me going into the meeting. Now the whole of that surrounding area had known me for years. I went from pub to pub, especially that you own a pub yourself. Everybody knows you then. All the pub owners know you. All the clients, oh, that's the guy that owns the big pub in town and blah, blah, blah. So they all knew me as a drunk. Even the cops. The cops in Ireland used to pick me up and take me home, drive me home and all kinds of stuff. I never got a DUI in Ireland. I got all my DUIs in England. But as a matter of fact, a few weeks ago I met a friend of mine who I gave my old license to and he did a year's jail on my license. That's as true as that was before the pictures. There was no pictures at that. Tony Kane was his name, the same last name as myself. And his sister called me. She said, "I just got a call from Wormwood Scrub." She said, "They have Tony doing a year down there." She said, "They think it's you." They have him in as Francis. So anyway, I went into that meeting, and I'm thinking to myself in the meeting, if anybody here knows me, it'll be terrible. And sure enough, I see this Tommy across the bloody room. Oh, good God, I thought to myself, he's going to go home. His daughter was in the same convent school that my daughter was in. I said, he's going to go home, and he's going to tell his daughter, Fiona Keane's dad was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous today. He's an alcoholic. Now, the thought didn't cross my mind that Tommy was there for some reason. So when you're dealing with newcomers, be very careful. They're very, very mixed up. Very, very mixed up. And tell them not to be talking this kind of shit out in front of normal people, because they do. I'm looking across the room, and then sure enough, after the meeting, Tommy comes over to me, and he says, "You know, Frank," he says, "you served me my last drink." I said, "I did." He said, "Yeah, that was 6 weeks ago." And he said, "Remember that day I was?" I said, "I do. Remember when you were in, all right?" And they were all hooting and hollering and all mad drunk. And so I was. He said, "You never took any money off us," he said. I said, "I didn't." "Oh," he said, you were giving us free drink." Not very good. Not very good for my poor brother Paddy, who was taking Valium at this stage. I'm giving the store away. So anyway, then this other young fellow walks over to me, and he says, "How are you?" I said, "I'm not good." He says, "When did you have your last drink?" I said, "About 4 o'clock this morning." He said, "Do you think could you hang on till tonight?" I said, I don't know." I said, "I haven't been able to get off this drink for about a year and a half." "Well," he said, we were all in your chair one time." I said, "Are you an alcoholic?" He was clean cut looking young fellow, about 6 foot tall, nice short haircut, looked very well. He said, "I am, I'm an alcoholic." I said, "How much would you drink?" I said, that doesn't have anything to do with it." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "How much you drink doesn't really matter," he said, "as far as it does to you." That didn't make any sense to me. I said, "I think I spent more of my time than the half of this crowd here ever drank in this room." And he says, "You might have." But he said, "Then again," he said, "some of them drank maybe more than you did. You don't know." He said, "It's quite a dusty." He said, "Obviously you're not here today because your life is going too good." I said, "How does this deed work?" He said, "Well," I "can't tell you that in a few minutes." He said, "Could you come back tonight, do you think?" I said, "What will be going on tonight?" He said, "The same thing," but he said, "you get the feel for this," he said, "and there's a book there," he said, "an Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book," he said, "you just got to read that," he said, "and you'll get the feel for it in a little bit." So, the grace of God, I went back that night, and the next night, and the next night, and the next night, and I kept going, and that was August of 82, and I'm still going. I keep going. And now I'm not nail-biting worried that I'm going to drink or anything like that. I don't have a notion that I'll take a drink. But I've seen fellas like me take a drink. I've seen fellas longer sober than me pick up a drink. I have buried them. I've buried a number of people in the time I've been in this fellowship. I'm involved with the recovery houses up there in Las Vegas. And I have first-hand, hands-on experience on a daily basis with these guys. Nice fellas. Some girls as well. We have about 10 or 12 women in another house. We have a women's house and we have 3 men's houses. And I see some of the nicest people doing stuff that they really, really would never do in their right mind. Doing stuff that when they get sober, they never do. But I see them do it. I see this disease of alcoholism wreak havoc, with the nicest people. And so that's not the reason I was going to meetings every day before I got involved in that stuff. And I'd like to think that if I ever quit doing that I'll still keep going to meetings every day. I'd like to think that. I don't know that. I can only speak to you about my track record. But in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have reaped benefits I mean, the benefit alone of lying on that bed up there today, looking at the packet of notes there and talking to Frank Sweeney like that and really meaning and feeling it, that's major. That's major stuff. If you can get happiness out of small stuff like that, that's on offer every day of the week. But people seem to think that it's about a lot of money or a big car or several properties or trips around the world. You know, I've talked to a number of people. I was out the other night to dinner with a man who's a multi-millionaire. And he busted out crying at the table. He said, "I killed my daughter." I said, "You did? How did you do that?" He said, "I spent over $1 million on her." He said, "Sending her into these treatment centers and treatment centers and treatment centers and psychiatrists and psychologists," he said. And he said, "I couldn't say no." You know, I couldn't comment on that. I just couldn't comment on it. All I could do was sit and listen to the man. But this man has more millions than I have, maybe hundreds. He's a lot of money. And I've talked to a number of people, maybe not with as many millions as he has. I had another woman sit at my desk. And she told me she spent over $1 million on her son. She said, "He's out now in Hawaii with a fried brain." That's called alcoholism. And you know, you can keep calling these treatment centers and they'll say, "Send them to us." She called next one, "Send them to us. Send them to us." And you know, when they're done sending them to us, then they'll send them to us, Alcoholics Anonymous. As of the year 2005, I'm proud to say that I'm a member of the greatest organization that has ever been in this world with regards to recovery from the disease of alcohol or drug addiction, Alcoholics Anonymous. As of today, there's nothing can touch it. We talk about track record. That's what I'm a firm believer in. Don't tell me what you're going to do. Show me what you've done. Show me your track record. You know, while I'm judging myself on my best intentions, the whole world is judging me on my track record. That's what it's about. Alcoholics Anonymous has the track record. Well, I started going to those meetings over there in Ireland, and I didn't believe in God. I was in a meeting one night, and there was a guy called Harry, Flash Harry we used to call him. And he was talking, and I remember this fellow in the park years ago. Years before that, in the park, with a big long beard on him and a cross around his neck and bumming cigarettes up him. He's now sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 8 years. And he's got a gold tooth. Nice gold tooth in. And he's got a cigarette holder. And he's smoking a cigarette in a cigarette holder. And he's got a nice suit on him. He had a pinstripe suit and a red tie. You'd think he was an executive. So I said to this little Rita beside me, Rita, I said, "Rita, how long is the Flash sober?" She said, now he was talking about how he didn't believe in God. And see, I didn't believe in God. So he's talking about how he didn't believe in God and blah, blah, blah. I said, "How long is he sober?" She said, 8 years. I said, "Good, that'll do me. He's got 8 years and no God. That's what I want to hear." So that was it. He got me over that night. And I'm sharing another time in a meeting, and this Red Eileen was there, and Red Eileen was one of these ladies who was prim and proper, and she would tell you the way it was. She said, "This is a wonderful program." She said, "It works for those people who believe in God. It works for those who don't believe in God." She said, and she looked over to where I was, and said, "It even works for those who keep their God," she said. No more than Samaritan House, you won't get away with much in this outfit. So anyway, I was plodding along, but I was in meetings every night, and I was listening, and I was checking people out. I didn't take much at face value, and I would ask you about him, and him about her, and her about him. I would ask, who is he, what's he doing for a living, where does he go to meetings, does he have a family? I would get the read on all of these people, as much as I could get, and I was coming to find out that these people, with these numbers of years, who claimed that they were asking God for help, couldn't all be telling lies. I doubted a few of them. I thought it was maybe lip service. But I found dozens, and the longer I was there, I found scores who were claiming to ask this God for help and give thanks at night, and they hadn't drank for 2 years, for 5 years, for 10 years. And I'm in a meeting one night, and this Big Paddy. We all have our own early day Eskimo or early day friend or early day whatever it is. And I had this Big Paddy that I bumped into in my early days. And I said to him, "What do you do in this outfit, Paddy?" I had him checked out because he was an ex-cop. And an ex-cop, he was a young man to be an ex-cop. And I was wondering why he still wasn't a cop. So they told me that he got out of the police force by the skin of his teeth. He just got out before they put handcuffs on him. So anyway, I did a bit of checking on him, and I said, well, I could like this guy. He'd have a kind of a track record now that I wouldn't feel ashamed hanging around with, because I felt that I had a bad track record myself. So I thought, this guy is a good person. I said, how many meetings do you go to, Paddy? He said, I go to about a meeting a day, he said. I said, what else do you do? I said, that's about it. He said, I just go to a lot of meetings, he said. And I said, I have a good life. So I started hanging around with him. And we started going to meetings. And we're in it. After a meeting one night, we were in this meeting one night in a little convent. And he said, gratitude is not a word. And boy, I came right up in my chair. I just knew right away. It's the first time I'd ever heard that. Most of you guys have heard that. But I hadn't heard this. Gratitude is not a word, he said. He said, I get on my knees in the morning, I ask for help, he said, and I get on my knees at night and I thank God. Well, after that, we went down to the hotel and we were sitting there. I said, Paddy, is it? Because I had been told that he was a kind of a con man, you know. I said, who were you trying to set up there tonight, Paddy? He said, what do you mean? I said, you're talking about getting on your knees and asking God for help. Oh, he said, I do, Frank. I said, Paddy, this is Frank. He said, I know. I said, he's smoking dope. He said, no, he said, Frank, he said, you don't believe me. I said, I don't. Well, he said, I did 6 trips into that Lomans. Lomans was the name of a mental hospital. It was a low-bottom mental hospital. He said, I did 6 trips into that Lomans, he said. You know where that place? I said, I do. And he said, I was the guy, he said, I'd be waiting for the victim to come in with the money. In Ireland there, you would, at that time, you'd know a lot of people. You'd know most of the people. Or if a guy came in the door, within a few minutes or a half an hour or a couple hours, you'd be able to find out who he was, where he came from, if he had money. He said, I'd always suss out the fellow with the money, he said. And I'd send him across the wall for the bottle of whiskey. Or I'd send someone across the wall for the bottle of whiskey. And he said, I'd drink the bottle of whiskey and be pretending I was doing the deal. But he said, the last time I was in there, he said, I got down on my knees, he said. And I said, dear God, please help me, he says. This is ridiculous what I'm doing here. And he said, that's 9 years ago, Frank. Now he said, that mightn't impress you, he said, but I'm very impressed with that. So I made some more inquiries about Paddy. I said, is he really? And they told me, oh, he is, he's a good fella, he's doing the deal. Well, I really hung around with him then. And in 90 days, I got down on my knees. And I took a third step, a kind of a lukewarm one. You know, the book says be sure you're ready to do this third step. Make sure you're of the right frame of mind and you do it with somebody you trust and all this stuff. I didn't do it like that. I just got down on my knees. And I said, dear God, I'm now willing to turn my life, my will over to you. Now I was like that. But I did it. Because I used to hear them saying, it's an action program. This is a program of action. I'd hear that a lot around the rooms. And I believed that. And sure enough, then I read on pages 64 there, it says that while this is a major step, it's of little value unless it's immediately followed by a thorough house cleaning. Step 4. I thought, oh my God. Well, I started working at the step 4. And that was in, they say, oh, September, October, November. That was November. Well, in January, there was a conference down in Galway, down the west coast of Ireland. And I went down there and I asked 4 or 5 different people for help with the fourth step. And I was amazed. I was amazed how little help I got. I thought these people had this deal stitched. You know, I thought they were wonderful. And I'll tell you, I wasn't getting much help with the fourth step. So I plodded away. I went out the book then and I started writing down from the book about the resentments and the fears and the relationships and the sex and all that stuff. And I just did a fourth step on my own, and I shared it when I was in a meeting. And this Eugene says, he said, I heard Frank share and he took a fourth step there. He said, I'd say he was only scratching at it. Oh, hey, pal. The meeting was over. I says, come here, I says. Would you like to do some digging or something? He says, get off your high horse and come on with me, he said. So I went up to his house with him. And at 2 o'clock that morning, he said to me, well, he said, now, unless you've held anything back, now you've done a good fourth and a fifth step. I said, a fifth step? Yeah. Well, of course I'd held something back. But guess what? At 2 o'clock in the morning, I blurted it out to him. He said, is that it? I said, that's it. Go home, he says, you're an altar boy. Well, I had my fourth and fifth step done. I was 6 months sober. Now, I skipped 6 and 7. And I'll tell you why. Oh, God. Newcomers thinking again. Don't trust them. You know, we all think, oh, nobody was as bad as me. They're as bad as you. They are as bad as you. Don't trust them. I'm 6 months sober. I think I can skip step 6 and 7. You know why? Because step 6 says we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. I wasn't entirely ready. And I had heard it said round these rooms, be careful of what you pray for or what you ask for, because you might get it. So I'm expected to get down on my knees and beseech God to remove these defects of character. I don't think so. Not at 6 months sober. I just wasn't ready for it. So I went on to 8. And I made a list. Started making the amends the best way I could. Didn't get too mixed up with the 9th step, because I took some very serious advice on the 9th step. I had some really serious shit that I really had to be very careful about on the 9th step. So I took advice from a number of old timers, and I took the 9th step gradually, little bit at a time. I went back, did 6 and 7, I did 10, 11 and 12, and I was working on that 9th step, and I'll be working on that like the rest of us till the day we die. But there were a couple of major bits in that 9th step. And you know, they were major in my mind. Here, Clancy talks about this as the disease of perception. There's a fellow up there in Caesar's Palace. The Sultan, they call him. He does the magic show up there. He introduces the magicians in that. And he says, what you believe is real, he says. Very true. Very true. The disease of perception. What I believe is real, it's real. I'm going to start taking action on that. Might be all wrong, but what I believe is real is real. So my perception of my 6th and 7th steps were distorted. I used to say that the 4th and 5th step came easy because I had God in my life then. Well, he was still in my life at 6 and 7. But we're going to leave him for now, you know, leave him for now. But thank God it wasn't a big deal. And the reason it wasn't a big deal, I firmly believe, is that I was sitting in a meeting every night. Now, if you sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night, 6 months or 9 months down the road, if you don't have a grip on this thing, you're a jackass. There's something really wrong with you. I was in a meeting last night down in the GVG club in Las Vegas there. And right up over the steps, it says, learn to listen. Very, very important. Learn to listen. I learned that in my very early days, and I'll tell you how I learned it. There was a fellow called Red Paddy. Now, Big Paddy was one guy, Red Paddy was another guy. And Red Paddy was a kind of an uneducated guy. But he was very well known, and he was very well liked, and he'd done an awful lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was very poorly versed in a lot of stuff. He could talk to Red Paddy about politics, about religion, or about history. He knew nothing about any of it. But he knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Red Paddy could say, if he was the last one to share, and he could say, and as Joe mentioned over there, and Mary was talking down here, and Arthur at the back said something, he'd have a little bit from what they all said. He'd remembered everything that they said during the meeting. I started thinking to myself, I got to do like Red Paddy. I got to listen here. I started listening. And I'll tell you something, it served me very well. It's simple stuff. all of the stuff I'm talking to you guys about now tonight, very, very, very simple stuff. I believe, you know what I believe, the biggest barrier to recovery, television. Well, I'll after this, well, there's a meeting in an hour's time. Yeah, I'll go to that one. I'll go in the morning. How many of you identify with that? We've all been there. Some of us a lot. Some of us a lot. And it's so simple. You know, they tell the story about the simplicity of the Alcoholics Anonymous program, very much like the story of the pupil saying to the master, "Master, what is Zen?" The master says, "Zen is working when you work, sleeping when you sleep, eating when you eat, playing when you play." The pupil said, "But master, that's so simple." He said, "Yes, but so very few can do it." Alcoholics Anonymous, over and over and over. Bill and Bob, 1935, Akron, Ohio. Bill Wilson, down on a con job from New York, trying to maneuver a few stocks around here, make a few bucks wherever he could. Dr. Bob, a proctologist. I wouldn't like to vent them around with my backside and have him and have him looking at it. He was screwed up. He was operating on people and he didn't know which end of him was up. Never mind the fellow on the table. And he says Bill Wilson gets to him eventually, as most of you know the story, I won't go into it, but eventually Bill gets to him to talk, to keep himself sober. He knew if he could get another drunk, maybe he would stay sober. And he gets to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob says, I can give you 15 minutes. And by the way, I've been preached at and prayed over. 7 hours later, one drunk talking to another, sitting across the table pouring cups of coffee. Now that's how this deal started, and that's how this deal is going on today. The success of this program is very, very much grounded in one alcoholic talking to another, or one alcoholic listening to another sharing. There may be 20 of us in the room, but it's one person listening to another and then passing it on. Bill Wilson was at an airport one day, and this young lad ran up to him. He says, "Oh, Bill," he says, "I want to thank you so much. You saved my life. My God, what can I do? What can I do for you?" And he patted him on the back. He said, "Pass it on, son. Pass it on." That's what this deal is about. This is not a me deal. Sweeney down there says it's a we deal. Truest words ever. It's a we deal. One alcoholic helping another. And I don't mean giving money, and I don't mean giving food, and I don't mean giving shelter. All of these things can hurt an alcoholic. Alcoholic is used to getting stuff like that. They're used to getting it. And they become very, in the last year of an alcoholic's drinking and drugging, they become so manipulative, that they will get into the back pocket of another alcoholic, much less the normal people. They'll get into another con man's pocket. Unbelievable the power of this disease. I see guys who are real con men themselves, and 3 or 4 years later they're sober and cleaned up. An alcoholic will rip them off for a couple of $100. And I said, "They ripped you off?" I can't believe it. But they will. Because the other guy who was a bigger con man himself, he can't believe that anybody was a bigger con man as himself. That's the way it is. That's the way we are. But you know, that's why this deal works so well, because we identify with each other so well. We just have the best fun. I'm tapped into what I lovingly call a pocket of enthusiasm in Las Vegas. I'm in the middle of a rah-rah deal with a whole bunch of people with long time sobriety. And man, we're hooting and hollering, we're going to meetings, we're eating out together, we're just having the best time. Sometimes we're at funerals together. We're at weddings, we're at christenings, we're at all kinds of dues. I can't keep track of all the stuff I go to. I go back to Ireland about 3 times a year. I was just over in Brussels and in Paris and in London. And I had the best time. The best time. And you know what? I go straight into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Walk in the door, tell them where you're from, and as soon as you mention Las Vegas, "Oh my God, they're from Las Vegas. Are you really from Las Vegas? How do you say sober in Las Vegas?" He says, "You know what they asked me in Las Vegas? How do you stay sober in Ireland?" That's what they ask me in Vegas all the time. "Oh my God, how did you get sober in Ireland?" Perception. It's incredible. Anyway, am I getting close to my time here? I know the worst thing that it's bad enough when a newcomer goes over, but when an old timer goes over, it's like, get a grip, boy. Anyway, I'm not going to keep you guys on all night tonight. There's a river out there, and there's boats on the river, and there's a great time going on in Loughran, and I really, really want you to enjoy yourself. One of the big things, when I go away to a convention, I go to a lot of conventions. I was over there at the All Ireland. Wait till I tell you a good one. Wait till you hear a good one. This is how they go on in Ireland. Last year, I'm over in Ireland, and this friend of mine, who I've known for years, says, Frank, he said, I'm chairman of the All Ireland Convention next year. He said, it's going to be in Galway. He said, will you be our speaker? I said, sure. So, now, in Ireland, they don't do it like here. You don't speak in Ireland for 45 minutes. You speak, like, for 10, 15 minutes, and there are four speakers. And half of them you can't understand. I can't understand them, much less you. You have no chance at all. I mean, the religion, my name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic, you only got up this morning, and I went to work, and the job was wrong, and the wife was this, and that. You think, what the hell is he talking about? But then you get four of them, you're like, whatever. So anyway, I said, okay, I said, I'll be the speaker, yeah. So I go over anyways and go up to Galway, and I meet Joe there, and I said, Joe, which night do I need to get dressed up? He says, what do you mean? I said, what night am I speaking? Well, now, there's a committee, Frank, and there's a bunch of them, and it's a selection, and there's this committee, and that, and I don't know. I said, that's not my department. So I said, okay. So I got dressed up that night anyway. I got dressed up the next night. I didn't speak any night. That'll thicken your skin up. That was just fine. I swear to God, it was good. I had a great bit of fun. When I go to these conventions, especially in Ireland, I know a lot of the old-timers over there. I know them here, too. And down here in Loughran, I know a bunch of them here. I'll be down in the hospitality suite, meeting all the old guys. I might even get to some of the speaker meetings. That has happened to me many a time. And it's not that I have any disrespect for the speakers, but if there's a bunch of the old-timers out there that I haven't seen, I hang out with those guys, we go down to eat, and we tell war stories. And that's what happens when you get a bit older in Alcoholics Anonymous. You just have a good time. So you guys who are new, you don't have to believe me, but talk to some of these other old-timers around. There's a bunch of them in this room tonight that I know personally. I've known them for many years. And we are having the time of our life. I said to Big Paddy one day, he said, how was life in Vegas, Paddy? I said, I'm having the life of Riley. I said, whoever Riley was. He said, you don't know who Riley was? I said, no, I don't. He said, he's over there in that country of yours. He said, down in Arizona. He said, there's a tombstone, and it says, here lies the remains of John Murphy, who lived the life of Riley while Riley was away. Anyway, that's all I got. I want to thank you sincerely for inviting me down here tonight. You guys enjoy the weekend. All right.